In 2009, Wayne County prosecutor Kim Worthy took a phone call.
It was the deputy chief of my special victims unit who was breathless on the other end of the line. He said, "Boss, you are never going to believe what I just saw."
That's Worthy at a TED Talk a couple of years ago.
He told me that he had just visited what he thought was an abandoned warehouse where the Detroit Police Department was storing evidence. Inside were 11,341 abandoned, untested rape kits. Some of them went back to the 1980s. These kits were spilling out of large black garbage bags and empty oil drums. Each kit represented a victim, mostly a female, that had suffered a violent sexual assault. Each of them voluntarily endured an hours-long rape kit process with the hopes that the results of that, they would find their perpetrator. And unbeknownst to all of them, all 11,341, those kits were never tested.
Since then, Kim Worthy made it her business to process this horrifying backlog of untested rape kits. And as we'll hear today, that work is finally almost complete. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Justice being delayed for, in some cases, decades for these thousands of rape victims is hard to fathom. But in 2009, there was additional concern for officials.
You know, the county prosecutor and others say that serial rapists were left on the streets because no one was getting the evidence, no one was making these cases, and no one was, most importantly, convicting these assaulters.
Bryce Huffman at Bridge Detroit has this story about the ongoing saga.
You know, this was a really embarrassing moment for the police department and for the city, but I think as a result, it made other cities start to really do this work, and it helped the city of Detroit in particular really change the way they think about testing these rape kits and the urgency with which these cases need to be tested.
Did the city and the county ever have an answer for why these cases and the kits had languished for so long?
There was no real answer given. City officials blamed it on people who came before them. County officials blamed it on the city officials blaming the city officials before them. So there was no real answer given as for why these kits were just languishing in a warehouse, aside from the fact that, cost was one of the reasons given. They were saying that, you know, until the department has the money to test all these kits, you know, we can't really do much about it. But that's not an answer that's satisfying to anyone who was involved in any of these cases.
Right. So enter Prosecutor Kim Worthy. She made it a point throughout her tenure and in campaigning for re-election that these kits were going to get some attention. How long has that process now taken?
It's taken about 12 years now. So from 2009, when the kits were first found, Worthy was pretty instrumental in trying to not only get the kits tested, but to prevent it from happening again. And one of the ways that she did this was by really working hard to get laws changed around how these kits were tested. So in the state of Michigan, now you can't just have a bunch of rape kits languishing around in a warehouse. Michigan law enforcement agencies in the state are now required to collect rape kits from hospitals within 14 days, and then they have to send these kits to testing facilities within 14 days of receiving them.
So, Bryce, when we talk about clearing that backlog over 12 years, what was involved in getting this done? I mean, I imagine there's the technical piece of it, but also the investigative hours on the legal end of the cases?
Right. So, you know, right now there's 199 cases still being prosecuted from 2009, and then there's 150 cases that are still awaiting an investigation. So what it took was a lot of coordination between the county prosecutor's office, the Michigan State Police, the Detroit Police Department, and then law enforcement agencies in other states, because one of the things that is maybe most shocking or most appalling about this is that about 40 states, including Michigan, are all connected to evidence from these kits.
Yeah. So this is something that was handled by multiple jurisdictions, yes?
Yes, for sure. It was county, city, state, and then other agencies from other states as well.
At the end of the day, we have, at this point, more than 4,000 cases closed and 224 convictions. That's incredible.
It is. And I think one of the things that is, you know, that sticks out to me about this is that, you know, even though some of these rape kits are decades old, Kim Worthy and her office, they really are committed to testing these kits and prosecuting anyone that they can who is connected to any of these assaults that occurred.
Were you able to get a sense of what kind of challenges the investigators were up against in trying to unpack these cold cases?
Yeah, so some of the difficulties were, you know, this evidence is fairly old. Some of the people who, you know, might have left DNA in these kits, you know, are no longer alive. Some of them are already in prison. Some of them, you know, some of the kits came back with testing that wasn't the most conclusive. So it took a lot of investigating beyond what was found in the kits to make some of these convictions happen. And as the county prosecutor, as Kim Worthy said, a lot of these kits involved serial rapists, you know, people who were raping 10, 15, and some even 20 people.
We have to take a quick break. We'll have more with Bryce in just a minute. Stay with us.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Kim Worthy has said that the kits and the work that went into processing them will help solve other crimes. Can you explain what she means by that and what she has in mind?
Right. So, you know, with these kits, it's DNA evidence, right? And if, let's say, from one of these kits, you find DNA from someone who was on trial for murder or in a robbery or something like that, the DNA from these kits could actually make connections between cases that are, you know, otherwise unrelated or seemingly unrelated. So someone might have left DNA at a crime scene that matches DNA that's found in one of these kits. So you're not just getting sexual assaulters off the street. You could potentially be getting murderers off the streets as well with this evidence.
It feels like all of this work and all of this effort, it's not going to mean as much if the state of Michigan finds itself in another 10 years with the same situation on its hand. What do we know about how these kits and these rape cases are processed today?
One of the big changes is that in 2014, a law passed in our state that law enforcement agencies here have to collect the kits from hospitals within 14 days, and then they have to send those kits to labs within 14 days of taking possession of them. That law also requires that the labs analyze these kits within 90 days if sufficient resources are available. And one of the big changes is that because of this case, the resources from county prosecutors, from the state, from people prosecuting these cases are going to be there. People want these kits to be tested as early as possible because that gives them the best chance of getting these assaulters off the streets.
I get that the laws have changed and that seems like a very good thing. But one of the things about rape cases is they tend to come with a lot of baggage on the side. I know right. That for the story, you talked to John Serta, a Detroit police captain in the Special Victims Unit. And he told you that what a lot of people, I think, already suspect, that a lot of survivors don't really want to talk to the police, despite the fact that there's a special unit. Did he say anything about the cultural changes that may have happened within policing or within DPD specifically to make survivors feel more welcome and to feel that they will be believed?
Right. That is something that's really important to rape cases, is having people, having police officers and law enforcement agencies believe the people who are telling these stories, because that is going to make the person, the survivor, it's going to make them more willing to work with law enforcement. So one of the things that DPD is doing is, instead of just having them talk to police officers, you know, people with a badge and a gun, they're getting these people in touch with social workers immediately. So they have someone who has more mental health training talk to them about what they've been through, about the trauma that they're experiencing. Because oftentimes, you know, police are trying to, they think about solving crime. They think about doing what it takes to, you know, get someone off the streets, but they're not always necessarily thinking of the survivor first. And that's what the social worker's role would be.
Right. After decades of inaction and then another 10 years plus on this, there's no question that some of the perpetrators and probably even some of the victims may have died before justice could be done. What are you noticing about the advocacy community? Are there any survivor groups that have materialized to try to support the victims, both those who were helped by the process and those who were not?
You know, there's a lot of advocacy groups in the Detroit area that, especially when the kits were first found, were very, very vocal about this issue and wanted to get the kits tested. But I think all of those advocacy groups would have to acknowledge that, you know, these cases, you know, the 11,000 that were uncovered, that's not the end-all be-all of stopping sexual assault in Detroit or anywhere, right? It's about changing the cultural mm-hmm. attitude about consent. And a lot of the advocacy groups that I researched when doing this piece, you know, they make it very plain that this is just one piece of the puzzle, and to really make things better for women and men, you know, who are victims, is that we need to change the way we talk about sexual assault. We need to change the way we talk about trauma, and we need to change the way we think about what might happen to someone after they go through something like that. And that, you know, all of those things together will make things better for not only sexual assault survivors, but it will prevent more sexual assaults from happening in the future.
And that's the Stateside Podcast for today. I'm April Baer. You can find full Stateside episodes at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis, and she produced today's pod. Our theme music is by 14KT, additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Williams.
I'm Lester Graham. We've been working on a big project about Great Lakes birds called The Bird Connection.
It will look at ducks and trumpeter swans,
egrets and herons,
and piping plovers. Yes!
We'll discuss what we've discovered at a Michigan Public Issues and Ale event,
including how some problems for birds are problems for people.
It's at Arbor Brewing Company in Ypsilanti, the evening of May 21st at 7.
You can register at michiganpublic.org.